This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and our conversation today is talking about the PPA with Pennsylvania State University and some of their sustainability issues. So Michelle Halsell is with the Pennsylvania State University, and she's going to introduce a couple of her associates over there who have been deeply involved in this project. So Michelle, why don't you go ahead?
As Sierra mentioned, my name is Michelle Halsell. I'm the Assistant Director of the Sustainability Institute here at Penn State University. And this particular conversation is about Penn State's efforts to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. This has been an ongoing effort for many years that has involved a lot of energy efficiency retrofits to buildings, converting our coal-fired power plant that's on our campus to natural gas. So we've achieved some significant reductions in our greenhouse gas emissions, but the next big chunk is going to be coming from renewables. And we finally reached a point where renewable energy would cost less than purchasing our energy, through traditional, off-the-grid, fossil fuel, coal-fired power plant type of electricity. So we started moving in that direction. I'm joined here by my colleagues, Dr. Peter Buckland, who heads up our academic programs in sustainability, and Dr. Megan Hoskins, who heads up our internal Sustainability Institute team that connects with our Office of the Physical Plant, and both of whom served on the committee that developed the RFP for our solar PPA and helped to evaluate the proposals as they came in. And they're both still involved in some of the implementation aspects. So they're going to explain to you how we really innovated our PPA process and emphasized a triple bottom line and some positive externalities. So I'm going to turn it all over to Peter and Megan.
And we'll really turn it over to Megan.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for calling in, and thank you for inviting us. So I will talk a little bit about the project that Michelle just talked about, and Peter's going to jump in with a few of the details as well. So just as some background, Penn State has greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets that they've started setting back in 2005. The next goal is for a 35% reduction by 2020 from 2005 levels. Back in 2017, OPP, our Office of Physical Plant, I will call OPP throughout the presentation, did a projection in 2017 and realized that we were not going to make that 35% reduction unless we did something big, that we had a gap of about 33,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent that we needed to figure out how to reach that gap. So they did some analysis to figure out if they could continue to do energy savings projects, which we've had a energy savings program here for 15 years that's done a lot of energy savings around campus. But even though those are really the best long-term projects, to do enough to make up that gap would have cost $45 million and would have been had to have been done and completed in 2 years. So that was not feasible. So they looked into purchasing renewable electricity. Solar has a really high value for our university because it's producing electricity during the times that we're using electricity. We also looked at wind and hydro, but those the prices are not quite comparable to what solar can do now. So we did a request for information that was issued in January 2018, and we really asked a lot of questions of the vendors for renewables at that point. We didn't limit it to solar for the request for information. We asked a lot of questions about what projects they have, are they big or small, and what does the size change the price? How many projects could be in operation by the time we were targeting, which is 2020, and then a variety of things about the developers. So how if developers are going to keep a project or if they will sell it after the contract is signed. We also were curious about what kind of land would be used. We know that either wind or solar requires some land on a pretty large scale, so we wanted to know what developers were doing on that land. We were also interested in if we could do it in-state, which was kind of a question mark at the time. So we got 18 responses out of 30 invitations, and it kind of proved that solar rates were really beating wind. We got projects in the RFI responses really from a pretty wide range of places. We got more in Pennsylvania than we were expecting, but we also got down into Virginia, North Carolina, and out in Ohio, quite a few in Ohio. But over 64% of the projects were able to meet or exceed the size that we were targeting to fill that 35% reduction that we were after. And a lot of projects could meet the June 2020 in-service date. So we generated a request for proposals. I think it was in 2018.
Let's
see that in here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. And we were looking for 60 million kilowatt hours per year. That was the amount that we figured was enough to fill that gap for our reduction. We were looking at the PJM region broadly, but we did have a preference for Pennsylvania, and we made that clear in the RFP. We did have an in-service date target for June 2020, and we had, right from the beginning, the desire to bundle the renewable energy credits with the project. So we didn't want those to be sold separately. We were looking at a power purchase agreement and for a term of 20 to 30 years. Just briefly, a power purchase agreement is when the developer brings all the capital to the project. They install the project on basically using investors, and then we as the purchaser purchase the electricity from the project and over time pay back that capital to the developer. And that's a fairly standard contract mechanism for renewables. So to generate the request for proposals, OPP convened an inclusive steering committee. They got people from around the university in obvious places like purchasing and the controller's office, but then they also included people from areas of the university that would have been needed at the end of the contracting process, but they invited them right up front. So they had the risk management office, the general counsel, strategic communications, folks from the Sustainability Institute, some faculty, some students. We also had a energy consultant from PRX Energy, so he was highly involved in the whole process as well. And I was actually working at a research lab at the time, the Applied Research Lab associated with Penn State, so that I was also involved there. The role of the committee was to determine the project priorities and weight those priorities, and then generate the RFP questions, read and score the proposals, and do the interviews and select the project. We were evaluating proposers on things that you would expect, like cost. So we were looking at the price of electricity, the size of the project. We wanted to make sure we hit that 60,000 megawatts per year, megawatt hours per year. We also looked at location. Like I mentioned, Pennsylvania is a preference, and the counterparty. So we really wanted to find a partner that would be there through the whole project and not sell it at the end. But we also included things in the RFP that were maybe not expected, and after talking to some of the developers after the process, they were definitely not expected and not things that they see regularly in RFPs. But we put in there three additional factors. One was Penn State benefits. So we wanted to be able to access the sites, use it for academics and research and outreach in the area. So we wanted accessibility to both physically and virtually, so access to the data that comes from the sites. We also wanted to make sure they were including the host community benefits in their proposals. So anything like taxes to the local community or any interactions with the local schools or communities in that way. We wanted to hear what their plans were. And then the last thing was the ecosystem benefits. Because we knew this was going to be a large land use project, we wanted to know if they were going to be improving the land and thinking about the ecosystem services of that land during the development and through the project.
So one of the things that was pretty exciting about this project, and I think really very innovative, was the partnership that we were able to forge with the Nature Conservancy, specifically the Nature Conservancy branch of Pennsylvania. I had the good fortune of having a friend in West Virginia who I was visiting, and I told her about this project just as it was starting to get off the ground, and she said, "You really need to talk to our chapter in Pennsylvania, because they're going to be thrilled to know that Penn State is going to do a big power purchase agreement, especially if it's in the state." So we got connected with the office here and were able to put directly into the RFP criteria that would protect what they termed the Connected and Resilient Habitat Network. So you can go online and you can look at these really pretty incredible maps that show these really high priority corridors for wildlife that need to be kept intact under a changing climate to ensure that our brother and sister species on this planet are taken care of. And so we were able to have a really good stewardship role. And Pennsylvania is really critically important in the Connected and Resilient Habitat network because of the migration of animals traveling through Appalachia and going northeast, sort of like right through the middle of the state. So actually just 3 or 4 miles from where we're sitting now is one of the, is the highest, the most traveled pathway of golden eagles across the northeast of the United States. So those forests were really important. So what we were able to do is put a map in and say, where's your project? Drop a pin, and then we would be able to evaluate where it was on this Connected and Resilient Habitat Corridor. And and I think that we had one response that was in it, but it was actually on degraded land. So it would have gone along with a good development standard that we were trying to build up.
Yeah.
So one of the other things that we wanted to have in there as well were responses to questions about how they would impact soil, surface, and groundwater and wildlife on site, regardless of whether it was in the corridor or not, and then how they would manage that. And so we really wanted to have a strong focus on ecosystem services, not just the fact that we were having zero carbon electricity.
Right.
Yeah, and then because we're an institute, a higher education institution, and an R1, a research one institution, we wanted to ensure that our faculty, staff, and students could have access to the site and to data coming from that site for research, teaching, and learning as well. And so we got that in there as well. Oh, sorry. So one of the things that has been interesting for me personally about being involved with this project is that I was also for about 4 years a local elected official and was able to kickstart an intergovernmental solar power purchase agreement working group, the SPOG, as we attractively call it. And one of the things that has been really interesting about that is that we've been able to get 6 municipalities, a council of governments, a county government, 4 authorities, and a school district to all agree, at least for now, to pursue a possible solar power purchase agreement that could be, that can use the draw of all of those groups together to get individual PPAs. By using the total electricity use of the group is about 30 million kilowatt hours. And so if we can pool ourselves, and that's really good. And one of the things that I think has been quite heartening in the process is that because we have the school district, we're able to potentially leverage the educational value of a grid-tied utility scale solar project so that we can have community engagement and children's education as part of that. So I think that, you know, thinking about what you all do and how you work, what the kind of intergovernmental cooperation possibilities may be for you.
So back to the Penn State RFP process, one of the things that's been nice about this project is that we, since the Sustainability Institute was involved, we can go out and talk about it, and our OPP folks have been very willing to share all this information with folks. So I gave a presentation similar to this to Peter's group just to give them more insight, and we're sharing the RFI language and actually the RFP language with people who are interested to see what we've done and learn from it. So for Penn State, when we sent out the RFP, we sent out 43 invitations and we got 15 responses. There were 25 distinct project sites, and 5 of them were in Pennsylvania. And we got all kinds of options of sizes and term lengths and in-service dates and escalators, and there was a fair amount of data to look through. So we used some tools that were developed both at the Applied Research Lab and also that our energy consultant had. So we had a pretty comprehensive evaluation criteria. So we had the criteria I mentioned, and then we took those so that we had questions that linked back to each of those priorities, and then we generated a master score sheet, which 4 of us from the full committee became a screening team. So we scored all of the proposals that came in all of our different areas and came up with a master score for each of our proposals. Those we presented to the full committee. We reviewed the results with them and went over highlights and all of that, and came out with 4 teams that we invited in for interviews. So we had 3 projects in Pennsylvania, 1 in Virginia. The Virginia one was definitely the best economic value, but being so far away, it didn't really have the optics that we were hoping for. The 3 other projects were break-even economics or better. So that was really fantastic, actually, to see that in the results. So the best project overall that scored the highest overall was in Pennsylvania, and it's actually 3 smaller projects near our Mont Alto campus, which is in southern Pennsylvania. And so LightSource BP is the partner that we selected. The benefits that we are hoping to get out of the project, and some have already kind of started, we're lowering our electric generation costs. So it's actually cheaper. We will save money in year 1 when we start purchasing electricity from this project. It gives us long-term budget certainty because it is a flat rate over 25 years. It's lowering our greenhouse gas emissions, obviously, and we're getting some positive public relations from it. We're already inserting curriculum and educational value, so I should say that's actually the research is mostly what we're focused on at the moment. So we have 1 of the sites, for example, will likely graze sheep on one of them, and we have a researcher who's going to work with the landowner on that. We have 1 of the sites is going to work on biodiversity plantings, so trying to get a very diverse mix of pollinator-friendly species planted on it. And then 1 of the sites, they're going to put in the infrastructure so that we could add a battery to the system at some point in the future. So definitely some potential projects there. There are also internship opportunities for our students. So I just heard the other day that the subcontractor building the site is likely hiring 3 students next summer to work on solar in the state, so that will be very cool. We're also reflecting student attitudes with this. Our students are showing some very positive reactions to this. We also, you know, Governor Wolf has the executive order, the first executive order from the year, committing the states to greenhouse gas reduction goals. So this, he actually came, the governor came to our groundbreaking event, which was held in September, along with our university president and the CEO of Lightsource BP, hosted a groundbreaking event, which was pretty pretty cool to see. We are creating jobs in the local community, so 50 to 100 Pennsylvania jobs over 6 months during the construction period. And Lightsource BP has been, we did put in their contract that they would hire local, and they really have been doing that. They are paying lease payments to the landowners, and tax income is accruing to the host community. We are also hopefully going to see those ecosystem benefits through the project. And with that, thank you for your attention, and we welcome any questions that you might have.
All right. That was a very interesting discussion. So anybody have comments or questions? I think we started out with a few earlier.
Hi, it's Bernie. I'll ask a question.
Yeah.
Here in Connecticut, we can do what we call virtual net metering, where somebody will remotely generate the power and you get credit for it on your bill. But here, it has to be within our Eversource, which is our utility territory. So the idea of doing something, for example, in Virginia, like you were contemplating, it makes me think that you have a different mechanism. Is that a generic capability that you can generate power anywhere and sort of get credit for it?
It's not exactly generic. It has to do with how we purchase our electricity. And our energy consultant worked closely with us on this. The way we purchase electricity is on a, in some cases, hourly basis. So it's not really a virtual net metering, although it feels like there's very little difference to me. But what's happening is, the solar project is generating electricity at, it could have been anywhere in the PJM network. And then we are agreeing to purchase that much electricity as it's generated, so in our market. So it's kind of like a market transfer, and you need an entity who works. So we have an entity that works with us to take care of that transaction, I guess. And I can't remember off the top of my head what the name of that is, but there is a name for that service that we are provided.
That's helpful. It sounds like you have an energy broker then that maybe helps.
Yes, America's PowerNet.
Okay.
APN is the people who do it.
Someone had asked just before the call began if this was located on our campus, and obviously from Megan and Peter's comments, it's not. It's 70 megawatts on 500 acres divided up across three separate parcels in a fairly, how many miles away would this be? Fairly remote.
About 2 hours.
2 hour drive from here.
Miles?
Yeah, it's just over 100 miles. It's very close to the Maryland border. So Franklin County is a Maryland is borders Maryland. It is very rural. It's got tight hills and then a long plain on it. This is just on pretty nice, rather flat farmland. And there are seven landowners, right? Seven farmers. Yeah, and to a T, they are all really quite excited about it and will likely become some of Pennsylvania's, assuming that nothing goes like horribly wrong, that they will become seven of Pennsylvania's solar champions.
It is the first. Philadelphia has also entered into a power purchase agreement a similar size
almost
and scale,
size,
almost
yeah.
the exact same size, but they have not yet broken ground. So
oh,
Penn
yeah.
State was the first. And I know this will sound odd to some of the regular participants in this call, where if you're in a state where you already have a lot of large-scale, utility-scale solar, but this is the first utility-scale solar project in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it's really it's a big change in the state. And I think something that is important to understand about Pennsylvania is that we are the nation's second biggest electricity exporter, the nation's third biggest producer of greenhouse gases, and we really are the powerhouse of the Northeast. So we really power PJM. And so if Pennsylvania changes, it changes the whole Northeast grid and therefore global carbon emissions. So having the land-grant university of Pennsylvania take this first big step is pretty, I don't know, it makes me very happy to have been a part of it.
It's Bernie again. Well, it certainly makes, I think, all of us happy, too. And I'm from Dubois, so I'm pretty close. But one of the battles we have here in Little Connecticut is what we call prime farmland. People get very upset if you're putting solar onto prime farmland. Do you mm-hmm. have a sense this was like one year it was corn and it was an active agricultural area, or was this like unfarmable area, or how did it interplay with the agriculture that had been going on there before, I guess is my question.
Yeah, so there has been agriculture going on the site up until 2 weeks ago. I think the one farmer just got his soybeans out right before they started grading the property. But yeah, it has been agricultural. A lot of it was pasture. Some of it was rotating crops. And really what they were seeing is these landowners were not able to make ends meet with the what they've been making from farming it. So the landowners really wanted to keep the land in the family, but were having a hard time, wanting to retire. The kids don't necessarily want to take over corn and soybeans or pastured, and I don't know what animals were on these properties. So really, I guess it could have been farmland, and it has been. But the other nice thing about these contracts is that it's written into the contract that in 25 years, if no one is purchasing electricity, the developer must take everything out and give the landowner back the farmable land. So it's not like it's being taken over forever. 25 years is a long time. But it's also improving the soil while the solar sites are there. And it's not necessarily taking it out completely. So you can also do agriculture at the same time as solar. So one of the sites we're talking about doing sheep grazing. So that's one thing that one of the landowners actually requested. And Lightsource BP, I think, would have said no, but since Penn State is their partner and we had already mentioned to them that we were interested in sheep grazing, we're going to do our best to see if that will work out. And then one of the sites will potentially do honeybees. So there will be some agriculture there with the bees. And then with the pollinator plantings, we're hoping to look to see if the pollinator services that provides will help the other local farmers in the area, because bringing pollinators to an agricultural area is a benefit.
So another thing, and this didn't happen on this project, but Penn State was approached by a company, and Megan could say much more about this, but at Agro Photovoltaico, right?
Mm.
And so having, really raised photovoltaic panels, you know, 15 feet in the air, you can drive a tractor under those. So you could still do a certain amount of, you know, commodity crop production if you wanted to. It presents a different kind of driving challenge, perhaps. But, you know, these kinds of things are not insurmountable problems. And one of the, there's a story that came out. It was in both the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and the Philadelphia Inquirer that you can find, which is about solar farming. And so really thinking as a farmer about harvesting the sun, and that you are in, it is simply a different kind of relationship to the sun than the one that you've had, instead of through photosynthesis, you're now having it a relationship to the sun through electricity production. And that it can actually be a lower impact form of farming, at least on site, because you're not tilling soil, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of, those are some of those potential positive externalities that we're trying to realize through this project.
Can I jump in there?
Yeah, yeah, sure. Go ahead and introduce yourself, David.
Sure. This is David Kay at Cornell University. I apologize for being late, but this is really exciting and very interesting. I wonder if I could just follow up a little bit with the question when you said that you're hoping to sort of look at what a lot of people call co-location benefits. Is there a, can you just talk a little bit more about, like, how you might do that? Do you actually have funded research that would enable you to do that? And my interest is in that this also in New York, is this issue is looming ever larger. And I think we'll continue to loom large, and there's a dearth of really good, there's some preliminary research out there, but it just really hasn't been looked at very well to look at what these issues are. So anything that you guys can contribute, I think, would be very welcome, particularly in northeastern climates and soils.
Yeah, so we're in pretty preliminary talks at the moment on the, and you're talking about the sheep, right?
No, any the pollinator crops, the sheep, you know, any sort of co-location kind of idea that in one way or another has, you know, more than one activity that has some sort of agricultural kind of slant to it with large-scale solar.
Okay, yeah. So we don't have research grants at the moment, although they are being, the proposals are being written as we speak. We have a professor who works with farmers in that in Franklin County already, so he's hoping to leverage some of the work he's already doing with partners to work with this landowner and on this specific application for the sheep grazing, at least. For the pollinator habitat, our faculty are always looking for opportunities for funding, so this presents a definite opportunity, but I don't think we have anything specific lined up at the moment.
I'll just, if I could just follow up, I would mention a couple things then. One is that there are some of our faculty are doing some research on related topics here at Cornell. If you're not in touch with them, you might be interested, and you may also want to, if you haven't already, check in with Jordan McNick at the National Renewable Energy Lab, who on a national level tries to keep tabs on this area of research around the country and also on occasion has some funding for it.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm pretty sure our Center for Pollinator Research is already working with Cornell for sure, and I'm not sure about NREL, though. I'll double check with that one.
Yeah, the Center for Pollinator Research, they have been, so when we were talking with Harlan Patch, right, is that right? He said that they're, and you may be connected to this, is that he said, you know, we're getting these kinds of requests now are coming in all the time, and, you know, variability, you know, climatic variability, you know, the presence of invasives in some sites and not in others, that it can really change, you know, what it is you ought to do on the site. And you know, there's this, he said, there's this idea that you just, like, scatter a bunch of nice pollinator seeds and poof, this magic happens and everything
right.
is absolutely good. And he's like, no, you can really, like, mess a place up and introduce things in there that you shouldn't, or accidentally make way for invasives. And so, yeah, it's we recognize, I think, really well, and we're really fortunate to have such a good agricultural science college and people like Dr. Patch who, you know, want to get out ahead of the issue. And you may know that in states like Minnesota has an incentive through law to do pollinator-friendly work on these utility-scale projects, but there's kind of no control around them. So you can be incentivizing a good thing, but that could end up having really pernicious effects.
Right, and something I haven't seen very much attention to at all. It's not really my area. I'm a social scientist, but the issue of how you can take conclusions from one context into different scaled facilities.
Yeah.
You know, there's a difference between a, I think you're talking about a 500-acre facility, is that right?
Yeah.
that and a like 50-acre facility or a 5,000-acre facility, you know, I'm not sure that the same conclusions are going to hold, even controlling for everything else.
Right. Yeah.
Scale matters.
I might also just quickly mention that there is the American Farmland Trust. For those in the Northeast, the American Farmland Trust is holding a November 13th conference on Long Island on solar energy farming and the future and its future in New York State. I could send Sierra information about that, or it might be of interest to people, particularly interested in this part of the issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question for you. How can what you're doing at Penn State apply to towns and cities across the country? I think it's extremely important, especially the part about the co-location and agriculture participating in the project.
Sierra, this is Jeff from Clean Focus. I would even put a finer point on that, in that, and I'm assuming the Penn State people know, the governor in Pennsylvania has mandated 40% renewables for all state municipal agencies by 2023.
Yep.
And the only way that's going to happen is to be able to, you know, really leverage this kind of project and things, just to, you know, because the majority of these municipalities and counties and things are just too small to really do something like this on their own. And so is there any kind of efforts underway to kind of aggregate this demand and, you know, make, help these guys work together and school districts, et cetera, to really streamline this thing?
Sure. So I think two things. One is that at Penn State, we're trying to figure out a way, and I think looking for funding to really scale this up so that the university can become the providing the seed and the soil for, you know, responsible projects like this to achieve the sort of scale that Governor Wolf has said, we're going for it. So that's one. On the other side of it is that, you know, different states have such different rules about intergovernmental cooperation and what even the forms of municipal government there are. So, you know, Pennsylvania has 2,560 municipal governments, and they range in size from a little tiny place like Loyalhanna Township, which has like 1,000 people, to a first-class city like Philadelphia, which has like 2 million or something like that. So we have this incredible variation, but they are enabled to work together through the Intergovernmental Cooperation Act. And the Intergovernmental Cooperation Act says that municipalities, school districts, authorities, etc., are able to work together for through they can form a council of governments through an article of incorporation, or they can create ad hoc working groups for a purpose, like a cable consortium or something like that. So what I described earlier, where we have six municipalities, a council of governments, a refuse and recycling authority, two water authorities, a transit authority, a school district, and a county government, all agreeing to say, all right, if we put our power, our electricity on the table, we have about 30 million kilowatt hours. So what is that? That's like 22 or 23, you know, megawatts of installed capacity, something like that. So if they were to go 100%, by achieving that scale, by putting that scale out on the market, they can attract a cost, an economic cost project that is very attractive to each of them, because it can likely compete with or perhaps now beat the dirty grid in Pennsylvania. So I think that it's really good to facilitate the interactions between governmental organizations so that they to get rid of the sort of geographic boundaries, because they all use electricity. And so I think there's a lot of power there.
I also think that one of the things that really motivates us is that Pennsylvania is poised to see, a tenfold increase in solar power in the next few years, which means that thousands of acres of land could be converted for solar, utility-scale solar plants. So this means that we would like to see it developed in a more environmentally friendly and socially just manner, because it could be developed in the traditional manner without seeing all these other benefits accrue to local communities and to soil health and pollinator health and habitat and et cetera. So we would really like to see promulgate this approach and make sure that solar in Pennsylvania is developed in a healthy way.
Yeah, and learning from what's happened with the expansion of horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing and the supporting pipeline industry, infrastructure in Pennsylvania, I think there's something that where we have a very powerful cautionary tale related to that, and we need to be really mindful of the way that that's divided communities, and that we need to be incredibly community engaged and not just let developers land grab and run roughshod over communities, even though we recognize that zero carbon electricity is vastly preferable to the alternative.
Most of these governments, too, we're surrounded. If you look at the place we're sitting right now, we are surrounded by farmland even here, right? I mean, there's so much.
Oh, yeah.
These little communities could, I think about the example of Germany, where small towns in Germany, farming communities, provide power to their larger, more metropolitan neighbors. So you could see how a place like Altoona or Allentown or places like that, Erie, could get a lot of their energy from their rural neighbors and maybe provide some economic prosperity to their rural cousins.
Now, this is Bernie again. Just to take that point, when you look at the dollars, we've done this analysis on a town basis in Connecticut, the dollars that flow out of our towns to the oil producers, to the gas producers, some of which are probably in Pennsylvania, it's huge. And the idea of keeping some of those monies circulating locally, I think could be very, very powerful. I'm not an economist, but I think having money flow locally can be a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Keep
it. One other quick thought. I think you're so big relative to this installation that you're consuming all the power all the time, but was there any thought given to adding some storage, like a battery storage, so that if you overproduce, say, on a cloudless day without a heavy air conditioning load and you're you can't consume it all on campus. You could store it so that you could use it at some other time during the day or the week?
For this one, we did not really consider battery storage. We will consume all of it on all of the sunniest days. This will account for 25% of our statewide usage, so we're not worried about it needing any storage. But we have another solar array on campus that provides 1% of our University Park campus location electricity usage, and we did consider storage on that one. But what we found is that the battery technology is not economically viable at this point, at least for us. I think that's changing. It's changing pretty rapidly, and potentially the next solar we do will include battery storage, but at this point, the value wasn't there.
So we also, in our area right around University Park, we have the University Area Joint Authority, and when it says university, it's actually not affiliated with Penn State at all, but it's the Public Sewer Authority, and the Public Sewer Authority has invested in, they right now have a 2.7 megawatt array, and they're bringing another 2.5 online pretty soon that will account for 70% of the total electricity that they use, but because they're a sewer authority, they have pumps going all the time. They're going to be way overproducing during the day, and they have a battery storage unit so that they can sell. Because it's an authority, they are enabled to do that. And so that's a way of linking solar and battery together through a public, basically a public authority, not a utility, so that they can maintain revenue and they can sell it back when it's expensive. Right, and make a little bit of money. So it is a long-term financial solution for them that gives them a lot of regularity. And I think that that's really pretty ingenious. We're lucky to be in a quite affluent region of the state where so they could sort of take that risk. But that's something to look at. And actually, I would say that they're head of engineering or the executive director, Corey Miller, might be someone who you all would be interested in having on a call just because of the way that financial model has worked and what else it does. It actually powers a beneficial reuse system that pumps Class A plus treated water back up into the aquifer for recharge.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Okay, so this is Sierra, and I'd like to have this on a webinar and get out to several thousand people and approach it in the direction of not just for universities, but again, how can you extrapolate this into cities and communities, towns? Some of the points you brought up are issues that a lot of people are dealing with as far as getting farmers involved. And the ironic thing is that the lower cost right now for soybeans and such actually is, according to you, initiating the interest in solar. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of amusing, actually. But I think this could be a very powerful webinar. And mm-hmm. Some of the points you brought up, I think, are extremely important. Especially working with your water utility as well. And I've heard of this before, but I think we need to bring that out so people understand the relationship.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
If you're
interested in getting connected to Corey Miller, or I think, you know, if you wanted Megan and me to do like an actual webinar, we can talk about this all day long.
Is that David Cornell?
Sierra, I would just also mention,
yeah, Dave, go ahead.
On some other comments that it's not just, you know, the issues around farmland conversion and, you know, all the issues that were being talked about in relation to farmland, they're not only by any means a consideration just for farmers, but they're very, a great deal of concern on the part of the public in the communities and in other communities where this is happening, at least in New York, is also part of the picture. And also, I'll just mention, I just sent an email to you that, again, you might want to share about an aggregator of demand in New York that works pretty much exclusively with municipalities that gives that has renewable energy as an option. So it might be another model to look at that other people in other states might be interested in.
Great.
No, that sounds very relevant. Go ahead.
I was just saying, thanks, Dave, for sharing that.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, I assume this will be recorded and online as usual.
Yes. Yes, it is recorded, and I'll send this recording out to all the members who weren't able to make it today as well, because I think some of the content is extremely important. And I think, well, it can apply to, like I said, municipalities as well as universities.
A lot of municipalities do have universities and colleges located within them. So. Yeah.
Oh, for sure, yes. And usually those are the more progressive areas of the country. What is your relationship with the utility with this PPA?
The electricity utility?
Right.
Uh-huh. Or the water.
Well, the electric, yeah.
The university has a pretty strong relationship with the utility, including the PJM and West Penn Power, who's our, who provides the grid connection. Because we purchase a lot of electricity, and because of who our energy purchaser is, he's just he is very good at what he does, and he built that relationship.
He is awesome.
Yeah. we have a pretty strong relationship with them, and they knew through the process that we were going to do this.
Okay. Yes, in a lot of areas you won't have that kind of cooperation, but I suppose with the university's energy usage, they will make allowances in lieu of losing you entirely to somebody else.
Well, one of the things about Pennsylvania, though, is that we have a deregulated energy market, so that's something to know. And then the second thing is that generation and distribution are separated, too. So the state really broke up the consolidation of power. In some ways, we don't have like a Duke Energy that is controlling everything, you know.
They're generators and distributors.
Yep, generators and distributors, and
they're separate.
Yep.
The other thing I'll mention is that we, Peter and I, have done one other webinar that is recorded and it's available online. It's on the ASHE website. ASHE is
the
Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Education. So we could get you that link if that's helpful as well.
Yeah, and it goes into more detail about what we talked about today, and it includes a little more information from Liz Johnson at the Nature Conservancy, and then Emily Wangerman, who's the Vice President of Business Development at LightSource BP, going into a little bit more of the science around the connected and resilient habitats, and then a little more behind the scenes of what LightSource BP, what they are as a company, and where they're situated, et cetera, et cetera.
And the project.
Yeah, and then the project in particular.
That website that you mentioned where your other recording is, would that be accessible to we have UConn, University of Connecticut, out here, which,
oh, yeah,
to my knowledge has zero solar energy, and they have a lot of land. They have a strong agricultural school, and I would love to see something like this take root. Is this your resource? Would that be available to them?
Absolutely, yeah. And I believe, so our colleague Doug Goodstein is actually came from UConn and knows Rich Miller, who is their sustainability guy over there.
Ah, okay. So there's a Good. I'm basically kind of a busybody, so I'm going to try to promote.
Busybody away.
Yeah,
do
it. But that webinar is available to anyone.
Okay. Will you send a link to Sierra so she can she'll get it out?
Yes, we will. We will get that done.
Oh, man, that's great.
We'll have this recording up probably later today, and I can get these links out either today or tomorrow.
Sierra, David again. Just another quick thought prompted by your question about utilities. The regulatory environment around this, at least in New York, has been rapidly changing. And New York actually Cornell had to file a suit a few years ago with the Public Service Commission to allow them to do some of the things that they've done in terms of getting renewables on campus. But I want to highlight that I think the state regulatory environment around these issues is going to make a big difference about what's feasible and what isn't. And ours has gotten in some ways significantly better in the past few years.
No, I totally agree with you, and I understand that across the country. Municipal utilities often have a better chance at some of these changes than they do on an investor-owned utility. But there's been some interesting things happening, too, like I said, with Xcel Energy in here in Boulder and all the way up through the Midwest, that they have been pressured into getting serious about renewable energy. Since we're municipalizing, they got scared, so... And Minnesota, I know John Farrell up there is working on it as well and has had a great influence on that change. So anybody else? We're just about out of time here. Go ahead.
I was just going to say Pennsylvania has changed a lot in the last few years as well. We just closed our borders for SREC purchases last year or the year before, and I think it was last year. And now there's some legislation winding its way through about community solar, which Pennsylvania has not been allowed to do community solar installations, but they're looking at changing that. So, yeah, it definitely changes regularly and has a big effect.
Well, that's really good news. I see changes happening in a lot of areas. I actually saw an article in the paper here about Wyoming. A utility in Wyoming is going pretty high percentage renewable, so that is pretty practically amazing in Wyoming.
Yeah.
Places. So yes, yeah. I would never have thought, but they're getting serious about it. So yeah, good thing.
That's great.
All right, everybody. It looks like we're out of time. Is there any more last minute thoughts or questions?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you guys. Thank you. Well, great.
Yes, that was excellent. Excellent conversation, and I want to make sure everybody in this group gets it, and also that we'll do a webinar on it probably next year sometime, early part of the year. Maybe I'll get back in touch with you, Michelle, and we can coordinate that then if you
like
are interested in doing that.
Yeah, we're hoping to go online in early 2020, so.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We'd love to
that's
more updates.
Yeah, that's it's impressive, actually, that you made that much headway on this whole thing. So thanks so much for doing this. Excellent information. And like I said, I'll make sure everybody gets it. If you have links to send out, go ahead and send it to me. I'll put them in my email.
Will do. Thanks, Sierra. Thanks, everybody.
All right. All right, now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right.
Bye.
Yeah, bye.